change hymns on. It's there for everyone. Some of you I know even have access to, is it the PMG? And that in itself can be quite a fairly accurate record prior to the minutes coming out. I say this because I was disturbed to see that it had been said by a member in this committee that, you know, they were now going to call on the Minister and the House to provide the RIA, etc., for the BBBEE Codes of Good Practice. I found that extremely strange when the Director General of DTI, Mr. Lionel October, had made it quite clear in an offer, not in response to a question, as part of the presentation, that he would be making that available to the Portfolio Committee through Mr. Hermans. He went on to also refer to the several number of submissions that were there. And when asked if, you know, that people could see this, what was the basis of selection, he made it clear that that base document would be available. The third thing also asked in committee, though, was with respect to the proceedings of the BBBEE conference held in, just trying to remember, I think it was it Sandton or whatever conference is? Gallagher Estate, yes. Well, held there. And he indicated he wasn't sure if that was done yet, but that could also be available in time. Now, I think that every member of this committee has an obligation to represent the facts. Having a different party political opinion is another issue, very different issue. You can oppose things ideologically, and you've every right to. And when information is refused, and you believe you should get it, but if it is refused, then by all means use the country's legislation to obtain it, as anyone should. But I take the strongest objection as chair for that kind of issue to be brought to my notice, for me to read it, and I really don't want to see a repeat performance of this, not while I'm chairing. I'm not trying to run a kangaroo committee. Thank you. Now, for apologies, Mr. Hermans.
Chairperson, we have a standing apology from Mr. Oriana Rossini. Mr. Khadebe has submitted an apology, as well as Ms. Everett Alberts and Mr. Kling. And now, no other apologies, Madam Chair.
Right, I missed the last one. Oh, Mr. Honourable Thring. Yes, Mr. Thring. The other point that we've got to just note here, just one moment. I just wanted to see. Yeah. Okay. Honourable Mabasa is here, and that's fine. But he also has to, I'm not sure if he would just indicate to me, is it a permanent early leave or just a temporary early leave? I'm not too sure, because I know it's a medical issue.
No, it's a temporary one. Consulting to leave now, and immediately after consulting, coming back.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mabasa. The third apology I wish to note, really on behalf of the department, is that the Minister is unable to be with us here this morning due to an urgent prior engagement. Well, not so much prior, as an exigency engagement that has arisen. So, but I have no doubt Mr. Karim, as DDG in the area, will be able to address that. And some of us may not be aware that he spent several years in Geneva on South Africa's behalf in the DTI. On that note, it is not my intention to finish at 1300, but to try for 1230 if possible. But can we have someone to please propose the adoption of the agenda? Thank you, Honourable Swanepoel, seconded by the Honourable Kwabasa. I should have actually prefaced my comments with an apology to you. I'm not sure, Mr. Hermans, if you were able to inform members that I'd be delayed. 9:30. Yes, unfortunately, I was in strategy trying to deal with programming issues which would facilitate our work. Over to yourself, you're very welcome, Mr. Karim. And, you know, take the necessary time you need to flesh this out. International Trade and Economic Development Division, and the matter is on the 9th Ministerial Conference of the WTO.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to all the honourable members. Thank you also for the opportunity to outline South Africa's government's approach and preparations for the 9th WTO Ministerial Conference, which will be held in December in Bali in Indonesia. I'm going to go straight into the presentation by first recalling some of the key principles that have informed our approach to the negotiations since its launch over a decade ago, and that are still pertinent, and some of the key elements of our objectives, and try to give an overview of what has been the evolution of the negotiations and what we can expect for the next WTO ministerial. I think the starting point for considering the approach to the WTO is obviously that South Africa's strong support of multilateralism. We see this as essential to managing the complexities and challenges arising from globalization and economic interdependence amongst economies. The only way to deal with these challenges is to cooperate and collaborate at a multilateral level. At the same time, we acknowledge and recognize that the rules that are embedded in the WTO that arise out of previous negotiations, including most recently the Uruguay round, contain rules and disciplines that in many ways are imbalanced and prejudice the interests of developing countries, and these would need to be addressed in the course of a new round of negotiations. We've argued that changes to the system should enhance the transparency and ensure inclusiveness in the negotiations, and as I've said, to be rebalanced in favor of developing countries' interests. Our support for the launch of the Doha Round was based on these essential principles, that we would identify these imbalances and work towards securing a developmental outcome for developing countries. The mandate of the Doha Round in 2001 contained a very important principle in which it was said that the concerns of developing countries would be placed at the center of the work program of the Doha Round. So this was in many respects reflecting what we had been proposing. More specific negotiating objectives for the round was to ensure an outcome that would enhance market access for products of export interest to developing countries, to look at the specific rules throughout the different agreements that make up the WTO agreements, to renegotiate those rules that perpetuate imbalances in the international trade regime. At the same time, we were seeking to ensure that there is appropriate policy space for developing countries to pursue their developmental objectives, including through implementation of one of the principles of the WTO, the principle of special and differential treatment in favor of developing countries. This is a principle that is embedded in the agreements of the WTO, and it allows for differential treatment of developing countries in order for them to pursue and address some of their developmental challenges. I'd mentioned this, that the mandate, the Doha mandate of 2001, required members to place the concerns of developing countries at the center of the work program. Now, in the course of the negotiations to address
to advance these principles in the various negotiations. We've built a series of alliances with countries mainly in the south, the Africa group. We had a group of countries that were dealing with industrial tariffs, that's the NAMA 11, non-agricultural market access. South Africa convened that group, and on that basis we were trying to advance a developmental outcome on industrial tariff negotiations. There's a G20 in the WTO. It's not the same G20 that we refer to at the international level, which brings together heads of states and finance ministers. This is a G20 grouping of developing countries dealing with agriculture in the Doha round negotiations. And then over the course of the negotiating process, there was the emergence of a group of G90, a large group of developing countries that include Africa, Caribbean, and Pacific countries. The ACP group includes, obviously, in that the ACP, the Africa group, as well as a number of countries that fall outside of that, but a very large contingent of developing countries within the group we've managed to build common positions with. Over the course of the Doha round, since 2001 until effectively its impasse in 2008, one of the main concerns that arose for us and many of the groupings that we were part of is that there were repeated attempts by the major economies to erode the round's developmental mandate. And these emerged in a series of proposals in agriculture, in industrial tariffs, in services, the range of negotiating pillars that made up the round. And in effect, what was at the core of this was an opposition by major economies to effect any meaningful or to undertake commitments for any meaningful reform in agricultural trade. Opposition to effectively reduce subsidies that distort international trade in agriculture. So there was a continued dilution of trying to effect that reform in agriculture, which was seen as a core developmental outcome of the round. At the same time, the same economies made proposals that put ever greater pressure on developing countries to open up the industrial and services sectors for exports from industrial countries. While it was aimed at developing countries in general, the focused efforts were on some of the larger emerging economies, mainly China, Brazil, India, and to some extent, South Africa, particularly on industrial tariffs. In making our assessment as the negotiations unfolded, we realized that these demands, or an outcome along those lines, would have very onerous effects on South Africa and would be harsh for our economy. What we saw is that we would obtain very little new market access in international markets, very little new access in agriculture, but that we were going to be required to take the deepest and widest industrial tariff cuts of any other WTO member. And that is a function of the formula that was developed in the negotiations. And it's a function of the nature of the South African tariff regime that emerged out of the Uruguay round. So we argued that this approach would perpetuate the imbalances that emerged out of the Uruguay round, and it was not an outcome that would be developmental. We thought it would be unfair and certainly unbalanced. And the divergences between the major economies and the groups that I'm referring to persisted for a number of years, and I think finally by July 2008 there was a recognition that that it was going to be very difficult to bridge these divergences. So effectively since July 2008, which was a ministerial meeting in Geneva, the negotiations negotiations on the Doha round have been stalled. There were numerous attempts to try to restart it. The former Director General, Pascal Lamy, had made a number of attempts to restart it, including through speaking to heads of state at various fora to try to move the process forward, but that didn't work. By around 2011, we started to see a set of new proposals coming out of coming from major economies, and and in 2011, there were two proposals, quite significant proposals, that were tabled in the run-up to the ministerial meeting that was held in Geneva in 2011, where a paper jointly prepared by the US and Australia proposed to move negotiations forward on the basis of plurilateral negotiations rather than multilateral negotiations. And the distinction there being that the plurilateral approach would be negotiations on issues where some of the members believe that there's a possibility of moving forward. So rather than waiting for the entire membership to move together, the proposal was that it would be something of a coalition of the willing. I think that was some of the wording that was used at that time. There was also a proposal from the European Union in the run-up to the Geneva 2011 ministerial, which started to identify what they said are the more urgent issues that need to be addressed. And they were proposing issues like energy, proposing issues, investment, competition, that these should be now taken on board. Our concern with those proposals, and the minister made a speech at the, a very useful speech at the last ministerial, indicated that both of those proposals undermined the multilateral principles that had launched the round, particularly the principle of the single undertaking. In effect, what the single undertaking is that you agree to an agenda. This is how the Doha round was constructed. You agree to an agenda, and that in order to conclude, you have to agree on all the issues. And that allows for a balanced progress across the range of items. Breaking that principle leads to a kind of a cherry picking of issues. So if you don't want to move on this issue, you identify other issues of interest to you and you move with like-minded countries, and that could create further imbalances in the international trading system. So what we've seen emerging, for instance, were strong proposals for negotiations on trade facilitation, but not on agriculture, because the developed countries were not interested in making progress in that area. We also argued that introducing new issues into the WTO are premature, given the unfinished business of the Doha round. Simply to add new issues would complicate what was already a complex agenda, and that it would, these are not that these are unimportant issues, but that it was premature to start dealing with those until we had finished the work we'd already set ourselves. And finally, I think the main point is that the position that the South African government has taken is that South Africa remains committed to concluding the round with all the issues that are embedded in that on the basis of the developmental mandate that launched the round and in the context of the principle of the single undertaking. Now, I think after 2011, there were some, well, certainly in the run-up to 2011, but the work proceeded afterwards, was a consideration of whether or not there would be any basis to identify a fewer set of issues that we could jointly agree to pursue as in terms of what has been referred to as an early harvest. Now, this would, again, in a sense, be a break from the single undertaking in some respects, but if membership was allowed, could agree to these early, to these issues, it could allow for some progress to be made on some issues. So there was a quite a lot of work that was done to try to identify what these issues could be, and in the end, in the course of 2012 and through the course of this year, work has been proceeding on a number of issues that could make up a smaller, more modest outcome. There's a pillar that is being talked about, a package for least developed countries, the LDC package, which involves duty-free, offering LDCs, least developed countries, duty-free, quota-free market access to the economies of developed countries and to developing, larger developing countries in a position to do so. It's a very important condition. Developed countries should give least developed countries market access, and developing countries in a position to do so should also try to extend that type of benefits to these developed countries. The LDC package also contained an attempt to address the concerns of cotton producers, particularly in West Africa, that have suffered severe reductions in their production and exports due to subsidies being paid in the U.S., in the EU, and in a number of other countries. So there was a request that we try to make progress on dealing with subsidies in the area of cotton. There's also been an issue that has been raised mainly by India, but a number of other developing countries as well. The G33, a group of developing countries dealing with specific issues around food security, have made some proposals on how to try to address issues in that area. There have been some proposals to deal with some specific issues on special and differential treatment to make them more effective, and there was the proposal to possibly also include the trade facilitation. So these would be the sets of issues that would be up for discussion at the Bali meeting. What we're able to actually harvest at the meeting is still an open question. Our own assessment is that the package is this modest outcome. Prospects of getting a positive outcome on this modest package are not particularly encouraging. So far, we've seen that there has been no will by the major economies to even discuss the duty-free, quota-free market access for these developing countries. There's been no appetite from them to deal with cotton, with addressing subsidies on cotton. We've had flat refusals to deal with anything to do with agricultural subsidies outside of a broader negotiating round, which we know is stalled. What we've seen in the preparations as far as where we are now is that the question of least developed countries' services waiver and the issue on rules of origin will effectively be non-binding undertakings, best endeavor that we'll continue to work on these, hopefully to have some resolution to these issues in future. The special and differential treatment provisions have effectively been diluted in terms of making any effective progress on those. On the agriculture tariff rate quotas, there have been some proposals. It's very technical. It's a technical issue, very narrow issue in the agriculture context that we have been looking to try to address, as well as the food security proposals that I've mentioned. Both of those face very serious opposition to progress at this stage. At the same time, where we've seen a lot more pressure from developed countries to try to secure a binding, full binding agreement has been in the area of trade facilitation. While I think there's a widespread recognition that trade facilitation is an important issue, and certainly in Africa we're dealing with it in the context of the SADC process. We're also dealing with issues of trade facilitation in the tripartite FTA. Essentially what it is to try to facilitate cross-border trade through improved documentation, one-stop border posts, a range of issues to lower the transaction costs of cross-border trade. While we all recognize the importance of it, the problem at the multilateral level is that these are subjected to dispute settlement, that if you undertake obligations to facilitate trade and you're unable to meet those obligations, you would be subjected to the dispute settlement in the WTO. And the fact of the matter is that when we try to assess who is going to have to make the most changes to their customs procedures and infrastructure and the documentation, the burden of the implementation falls on weaker, poorer economies, particularly in Africa. Now, when the mandate for the trade facilitation negotiations was constructed in the launch of the Doha Round, there was a link between taking obligations under trade facilitation with the provision of sufficient and adequate capacity to implement those obligations. So it's written into the mandate of the Doha Round that if you're asking poor countries to implement these obligations, you need to provide them with the capacity to do so. That's very clearly spelled out in the mandate. But what we've seen is that donor countries are unwilling to make any legally binding commitments to provide the capacity that would be needed to implement those obligations. So again, there's an imbalance in the approach in the sense that they're pressing for countries to take on the obligations but refusing to take on obligations to provide the capacity to do so. That's probably at the core of the discussions now. There have also been concerns that the way that the trade facilitation agreement has been constructed is an attempt to reduce the scope for developing countries to take differential commitments under the provision of special and differential treatment in favor of developing countries. So the objective has been to continually narrow the level of commitments that developing countries would have and bring it up to the standard of developed countries, even though we all recognize that we're not at the same level of economic development. So those are also a set of issues that raise concerns in the negotiating process. And then I think finally, there are some differences even between the major economies on some of the provisions in the trade facilitation agenda. So, for instance, the U.S. has standards that it is looking for that match their own regime in the U.S. that doesn't correspond directly to standards that are set in the EU and others, and trying to get closure or closing the gaps between those hasn't been successful up to now. The negotiations are still moving on. The preparations are still moving on. Initially, the idea was that all of these processes would need to be concluded by last week, but I think on Friday last week, the new director general from Brazil, Roberto Azevedo, has extended the negotiations till the 11th of November, so it's given themselves some more time to try to see if we can close these gaps between in the next 10 days effectively. There will be a general council meeting on the 11th, if I'm not mistaken, or soon after the 11th, and then whatever progress has been secured at that point will be put into a package of documents that will be submitted to the ministerial conference for consideration in Bali. So what we see really is, depending on how things go in the next week or so, probably the most significant outcome in Bali will be a commitment to continue the work post-Bali. So the solution will be a procedural solution. We can't solve everything in Bali, so we try to get some kind of political commitment to continue work on this limited agenda post-Bali. But we'll have to see where we are by the 11th of November to see exactly what is being expected of ministers in Bali. Our own preparations for Bali, we've had the ongoing consultations in NEDLAC in preparing positions on all of these issues. We have this engagement with the portfolio committee. We have a national consultative conference which is scheduled for the 14th of November. At that point, the state of play and the preparations of what is going to be expected in Bali will be much clearer then.
Just a minute, DDG. Will all the members try and take an interest in what has been said now, especially those who are hoping to accompany the minister to Bali? Honourable Hill Lewis, can you just put that down, please? Yes, I'd like you to show you are listening as well, because this directly affects yourself. Please. Right, I said, please just put that down for the moment. Right, DDG?
Just to say that we had a Africa Union Trade Ministers meeting in Addis Ababa last week. Part of the work of that meeting was to prepare a declaration for the AU for these negotiations, and the points that I've raised and the concerns that I've raised in the presentation are largely contained in an African position preparing for Bali. Certainly we'll be able to circulate and share that declaration to give a sense of the Africa Union position as we are now. We're all aware that the delegation to the 9th ministerial in Bali will include members of parliament, NEDLAC constituencies, business, labour and community. So as is tradition in our approach, and it's an unusual approach in the international system, I think we're one of the only countries, if not the only country, to take such a broad delegation of constituencies and members of parliament as part of the delegation to these WTO conferences. Once we're there, we expect that there'll be a series of consultations, including with IPSA countries, India, Brazil, South Africa. There's some talk of having a consultation there with our BRICS partners, and I'm sure there'll be meetings also with the Africa group and the ACP group that we will participate in, but those have not been indicated as yet. Chair, that brings me to the end. I think it's difficult to be absolutely categorical at this stage on what is going to happen in Bali, because the process in Geneva is still ongoing. The Director General is trying to do as much as he can to keep pressure on the process to try to get as much agreement on as many issues as he can. He wants to be able to deliver something in Bali, but it does seem to us that on most of the issues for the package there seem to be still significant divergences amongst the member states, and it's not clear whether or not we'll be able to that the members will be able to close those by the time we get to the end of this negotiating period, and certainly by the time we get to Bali. Thank you very much, Chair.
very much, Mr. Karim. I think this really also just fills in some of the gaps we had in our own trade report and brought us up to line. But I think members, as we engage in on this report, let us also remember the issues that arose when we went through our own trade report over the last 4.5 years, and also feel free to utilise this time to clarify them with the DDG itself. So I'm not going to take up more of your time. Can we see by show of hands who would like to comment or raise a question? Honourable McIntosh, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable James, Honourable Kwabasa, and Honourable Waili. Thank you. In that order, please.
Madam Chair, thank you once again to Mr. Karim. He always has very good presentations, and it's always an education for me to see how these trade people do their negotiations, and there never seems to be any great rush. Madam Chair, just he used a term which I didn't quite understand, and it wasn't, maybe it'll help me. What is a DFQF? That's the one question, which is linked, I think, to Agri-TRQs. And then purely as a matter of interest, since you raised the matter, Madam Chair, is I've always associated barley with honeymoons and Australian surfers. Now I gather that the Honourable Jordan Hill Lewis is on his way there. And maybe you could tell me who else is going in the party from the South African side. And, of course, obviously our committee.
Thank you, Honourable McIntosh. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Karim, for the presentation. Firstly, just to say, in terms of preparation for the ministerial, it would be great to get documents with the actual detail of what's being negotiated and agreed to in each of these line items. Obviously this is just a broad summary, but it would be nice to prepare oneself with the detail. Firstly, just in terms of South Africa's approach, I'm not sure that, I mean, there's an extent to which hoping for the Doha round to be resurrected is just wishful thinking, is there not? Because it seems about as dead as it's going to be. I mean, plurilateralism has shown some significant gains for trade around the world in the last 5 years, and I wonder whether we are not missing that boat, and I'd like your comments on that. Then in terms of what's specifically being agreed at Bali, the rules of origin and the services agreements, I see that that's going to be a non-binding undertaking. I mean, in your experience, does that have any meaning, in effect, if it's a non-binding undertaking? What's the point of that, basically? Then you said that tariff rate quotas, did I hear you correctly saying that that's a relatively minor issue in agricultural trade? My understanding was that it was still quite a significant issue. Why is there so much pushback if it's still a minor issue? But I may be wrong. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable James.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you for the very thoughtful and thorough presentation. I had two questions. One very close to home. There happens to be a very nice article in today's Financial Mail about Lesotho and Swaziland and what a free trade zone would mean for them.
in particular Lesotho. And so, because what will happen, as you know, is that goods will be landed in that, in Lesotho, for example, manufactured and then re-exported without any kind of customs intervention. So the revenue loss of them is quite considerable, somewhere between 35% to 40%. And so our political management, if that's the right word, of integration in the region and the creation of a free trade zone and our record on that score in doing that successfully is clearly an issue that may or may not come up at the WTO, but I just wanted your comment on that. And then I wanted to, a second question is to ask, what it is the department had in mind when it let the bilateral treaty with Germany lapse or cancel, and where the new system is not yet in place. I mean, what's the thinking in DTI in terms of not having a plan, is the impression, to migrate from the old regime of bilaterals to the new regime? I mean, the new regime is not in place yet. I mean, what's the thinking? How does one explain that?
James,
thank you, Chairperson. Just on slide 4, page 2, if Mr. Karumpo could just explain bullet 3, it seems to me quite strange that South Africa faces, as it says, a deeper and wider industrial tariff cut than any other member in the WTO. What does that mean? Just a little bit of clarity and detail there. And a general question, Chairperson, is my second point. What lessons have, with particular reference to trade negotiations, what lessons have been learned from the global crisis and the Eurozone sovereign debt? Because it seems to me that people are just digging into their heels without really learning any lessons that should take the global trade forward. The last comment I would like to make, Chairperson, and I think this is the issue we discussed just so shortly before that the 8th ministerial conference, that plurilateralism, which is simply nothing more than ganging up of the willing partners to undermine multilateral institutions in general and in particular at the WTO, to the extent that you would render the WTO an irrelevant institution to a great detriment of trade negotiation. That's our understanding, and we don't think that approach is proving to succeed. Quite different from probably bilateral agreements that normally countries would enter into. This is a strange and a very dangerous end. If you could comment on that as well. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Comrade Chairperson, and thanks to Mr. Karim for the presentation, which is informative, but also with the worrying side. I think there are just a few areas which I want to raise. One is the, since there's been a dispute during the Doha round since 2008, the question of what has been the impact of that particular impasse to the developing nation. Because we know that in terms of the recent report which we have entertained in the committee, we have seen that there's a growing trade deficit between us and some of these particular countries. But to what an extent are some of those elements of the impasse pose a serious threat to some of the developmental goals, be it the national development plan and all other developmental priorities of our government. The second area which I thought you would touch is the global economic crisis 2008 and the recent one in the Eurozone crisis. Going to Bali, to what an extent is that going to influence the rigidity of the position of those particular countries? Because the current prevailing situation in Europe may force the rigid position from some of those countries. The third component is in relation to the Africa. The unit of Africa is always a questionable unit. It's important, but because of our historical background as Africans, your Francophone, Anglophone, to what an extent are we a coherent, a united force as Africans? Because the recent reports have indicated some of the areas where we don't agree 100% with some of our African brothers. To what an extent, because we've got different socio-economic situation in these countries in the African continent, because some don't have strong industrial base. To what an extent can that pose threat to ourselves as Africans? I think those are some of the issues. But the last one is in relation to the agriculture. I've heard that recently there's been the issue about the black spot in the citrus. Can you unpack more as to currently what are those some of the agricultural projects, the products which are facing a major threat? Your citrus may be one of them, but you can touch others. But what are the mechanisms or strategies to engage in that particular front? Thanks very much, Committee Chairperson.
Honourable Swanepoel.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got two questions about negotiation strategy from the Department side. The first is, and it links a bit to what Honourable Wayili said, what is the state of preparedness of our compatriots in Africa? Has thought converged in Africa? Are we going as a united voice into those negotiations? That's the first part. The second part is that I know that there are major differences between the larger developing countries such as China and India with the United States and Europe. And the question is, how far apart are they still? Because if we're looking at a single mandate agreement, if those countries are not going to get any closer to each other because the cliff is so wide between them, then the question is what purpose and what chances there are of success in the broader community. So that's the one side of it. Then just to help me a bit, because I'm new to the committee, is you've mentioned in the report here there are key problems with burden of implementation. You said there's no agreement with some standards, etc., etc. It would be helpful, I think, if we can have some practical examples. And, the Honourable Member from the DA, Hill Lewis. Honourable Member Hill Lewis also said if we can have some more detail about that. But if we can look at some practical examples so that when a person does engage with industry and with diplomats, etc., you can highlight these practical differences between the two parties. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Swanepoel. I think, Mr. Karim, if you would try and respond then as far as possible to the questions raised, but also the comments that have been made.
Let me first start by with an apology for all the acronyms. These are in my head, and I think for all of us working in the department, we work with these every day, and it becomes second nature, but they are not very useful without explaining them. So I'll just go through all of them. The DFQF is duty-free, quota-free market access. So it's basically, it's essentially opening your markets entirely to those products from the LDCs in this context. The ROO rules of origin, and those rules are closely aligned with market access requirements. It's you open your market to LDCs, but you require that those products actually come from the LDCs, that they're not transshipped through another country. So the rules of origin clarify that the goods that you're giving the preference to actually come from the country that you intended to come from. So rules of origin are very important. Agricultural TRQs, tariff rate quotas. And the tariff rate quota is a way of making a market access concession to a partner by saying we're not going to open our entire market to you, but for a portion, for a certain amount, a quota, we can give you an advantage. So you're not going to open up fully, say, on wheat, but for 100,000 tons of wheat, the normal tariff would be, say, I'm just giving an example, it would be 100%, but for 100,000 tons, we will give you a quote, a tariff of 50%. So it gives a bit of an advantage on that. That's the idea of a tariff rate quota. I think and then the last one is SND, which is special and differential treatment. It's a principal provision in the WTO, I can't recall the exact wording, but it's special and differential treatment provisions. It gives a principle of special and differential treatment in favor of developing countries, where developing countries either take on lower obligations in terms of commitments because of their level of development, or they have a longer time period to implement that obligation. Developed countries may have, say they'll do it in 5 years, and say that developing countries, because of their capacity, will take 10 years. So it allows for that type of flexibility in the implementation of commitments. The Honourable Gordon Hill raised some questions. I think on the question of documents, we'll put together a pack. It's a bit of a moving target at the moment, but certainly by the 14th, by soon after the 11th of November, we'll have all the documents, and we'll put those together, because that will be the final set of documents, and that will give a clear idea of the state of the negotiations and progress made on that. The question about whether or not the Doha round is dead, and maybe it's wishful thinking that we continue to hold to a position, particularly in light of the fact that plurilateral negotiations are already underway, is a question that we will have to grapple with. I think it's come up in a number of the comments by the honourable members, and the essential points. I mean, I think as we develop our thinking around this, the essential point is that to understand really the dangers of plurilateralism. And the dangers are that if you are excluded from those processes, you are further marginalized in the international trading system. And what plurilateral process does is it creates a two, perhaps a three-speed international trading system. And it starts to fragment the rules that the multilateral system is attempting to enshrine in very definition of multilateralism, that these rules apply to everyone, taking into account differences in levels of development. But what we're seeing now is a move, a turn away from the multilateral process and pursuit of plurilaterals, which to date have excluded all of Africa. For instance, there's not a single African country in any one of the plurilaterals. So again, Africa is being marginalized from these processes. That's the one serious concern, I think, that we'd have to try to come to terms with. The other is that when you get groups, and we call it coalition of the willing or like-minded, deciding to work on their own, very often what is happening is that they're defining an agenda and they're defining a set of standards which suit their level of economic development and their objectives. Now, that may not be consistent with what countries in Africa, for instance, may need, or in, I mean, I think there are no plurilaterals that involve, fully involve all the emerging economies. So Brazil is excluded, India is excluded. China is trying to participate in one or two of these, but they haven't been entirely successful. So effectively what is happening is that there's a fragmentation. Now, what is South Africa's position? That's the question. What is South Africa's position vis-a-vis that? We can say, well, it's a reality that we have to accept on the one hand. On the other hand, we may not want to accept it. We may want to insist that for the coherence of an international system, for the given the importance of multilateralism, that we continue to speak out against processes that fragment the international system. Now, because it's happening doesn't necessarily mean that we have to accept it. We can see that it's a reality, and I think the position that the government has taken up to now is we understand that it's going ahead, but it is certainly not a solution to many of the problems. Most of the developmental concerns that we have that we've identified as part of the package of the Doha Round, and primary amongst that, is reform of agriculture, where developing countries have, and African countries have, a great deal to gain if subsidies were removed. That has not been addressed. And so all the plurilaterals, you won't see a plurilateral on the question of agriculture. You'll see a plurilateral perhaps on services or on other issues of interest to the industrial countries, but the concerns, our core concerns, are not being addressed in those plurilaterals. And I think that's quite important. And that comes to the question that was raised by Honorable Wahile about what has been the cost of not concluding the Doha Round. It means that all the imbalances that we identified in the Uruguay Round remain in place. It means that we have been unable to address subsidies in agriculture, export subsidies or domestic supports that distort international trade. And so long as we don't conclude the Doha Round, all the issues and concerns that we've identified remain in place and imbalances remain in place. So that is really the cost. I don't think there's been a evaluation of that cost. I don't know of any studies that have tried to say what would be the benefit yet of this, because the negotiations, no one has actually said that we're not going to conclude the round. There's just effectively an impasse, and it may be de facto that we're not making progress, but no one has said the round is dead. Even the U.S. has not come out and said that they're walking away from the negotiating round. There's a question of what does non-binding mean? And it would be too much to say it has, you know, if there are provisions, it would be too much to say that it's meaningless. But effectively, there are no legal commitments that arise out of that. So if we get an outcome in Bali that says the ministers agree to continue work in these areas, that's probably what we're going to see on services and on rules of origin and other areas where there's no clear agreement. So it will be, it won't be a decision, a clear decision that is binding on members to implement those things. It will be simply an undertaking for work to continue. So it's not nothing, it's something, but it's not as much as obviously the LDCs would have wanted on that. On the TRQs, the main issue was, I mean, it is an important issue, but I think in the scope of the negotiations on agriculture, it is a relatively small issue. And what was really being proposed was greater transparency in the application of tariff rate quotas by countries. How the EU or the US or South Africa, how you actually apply a tariff rate quota, is it transparent? What is the fill? So if you've given a quota of 100,000 tons for wheat, does 100,000 tons actually come in at that lower tariff? So it's really a question of transparency. But it seems that some members are not prepared to give that transparency, because what it would probably show is that there's a lot of underfill. And that would mean that other exporters would be able to pursue that underfill to try to fill it, and that has an impact on domestic producers. So there's been a resistance to that. There's also been a proposal from some that the original formulation of the TRQ was directed at developed countries, because they've set most of the TRQs in their tariff schedules, that they should be providing, as part of the developmental objective, they should be providing this transparency and addressing the question of underfill. They've turned it around to say, well, if we're going to do it, you have to do it as well. So that's also, again, narrowing the S&D provisions in that, and has also led to some difficulties. On the question of the FTA in the region, and Honorable James' question about perhaps the impact on Lesotho, I think there's no doubt that FTAs and all trade agreements that reduce tariffs will have an effect on revenue. And one of the concerns, particularly in African countries where government finances depend extensively on revenues from tariffs, this is a big issue. And it's been one of the concerns of many countries, even under the economic partnership agreements with the European Union, as well as other FTAs, that further tariff reductions has a significantly negative effect on government revenue. In our case, it's different. In South Africa's case, it's different. And this is because government revenue, a very small proportion of government revenue, comes from tariffs. So for us, the question, and I think it's probably less than 3 or 4% of total government revenue is derived from tariffs. So it's not a significant impact for South Africa. And it affects, and that same approach, the fact that we have a regional arrangement in SACU that involves a revenue sharing formula means that tariff liberalization at the SACU level has not led to revenue reductions for countries that are in the region, like Lesotho, Swaziland, Botswana, and Namibia. In fact, since the tariff liberalization process in South Africa, in SACU, has been unfolding, aside from the difficulties during the crisis in 2008 and 2009, 2010, revenues have consistently risen. And we're anticipating next year that the revenues would be the highest ever for the region, because it's calculated on the basis of total imports. So the pool is continues to grow, and the way the revenues are shared, these countries don't suffer in the same way as many other African countries do. So it's different impacts on it, but the question of revenues is obviously a consideration in the negotiations. On the question of the bits, and I'm a little bit hesitant to speak now. The minister is going to give a full briefing on Monday, and I don't want to in any way preempt what he's going to say on Monday. Perhaps safe to say that our overall assessment is that the presence or absence of bids has very little to do with actual FDI inflows. This is an empirical fact that has been established worldwide by many, many studies. You may see in the course of today reports. UNCTAD is releasing the latest reports on FDI flows to South Africa, and it's extremely interesting news in that South Africa's FDI for the first half of this year has been quite outstanding. Despite all the problems and concerns everyone has raised about labor unrest and difficulties in the South African economy, low growth. We have got, I haven't read the report in detail, but very significant FDI flows for the first half of this year, reaching levels last seen in the mid, say about almost a decade ago, from 2005, 2006. So significant increases in FDI, which have very, very little to do with the bids. I'll also draw attention to the fact that Germany, I mean, despite the German question of the bid, Mercedes-Benz announced a major expansion of its investment just a couple of weeks ago. So the link between bids and FDI is really very, very tenuous, and South Africa provides significant and effective protection for all investment in South Africa. The Honourable Kubasa asked a question about the effect of the formula, why South Africa was in this situation. Over the course of the on industrial tariffs, why we would take the widest and deepest cuts of any WTO member, is a number of factors in this. The first is that during the Uruguay round, we undertook obligations and tariff cuts as a developed country. And what that means is that the difference in our applied rate, the rate that we actually apply to imports and our WTO commitments, is very close. I think the ministers quite often mention the water between the commitments we've taken in the WTO, that we will keep our tariff no higher than a certain amount, and the actual amount, actual tariff that we apply is very close to that across most of our tariffs.
I'm not going to stop you entirely, Mr. Karim, but before they leave, let us just acknowledge the Ikemeling Women's Club, I hope that's correct, from the Free State, Kwakwa. Yes, so this is Mr. Xavier Karim, the DDG of International Trade and Economic Development in the Department of Trade and Industry, speaking about trade, especially the World Trade Organization, which is holding a meeting in Bali in November, in December. And the committee is trade and industry. So we are busy listening to him and trying to get the position that our country is adopting there. Thank you. Do continue, Mr. Karim.
Thank you very much, Chair. In the course of the negotiations, a formula was adopted and became the basis for the tariff liberalization. And what the formula effectively does is that it targets your commitments that you've made in the Uruguay round, the level of tariff that you say that you're not going to exceed in the Uruguay round, and the highest tariffs are cut the deepest, the furthest. So what it does is it leads to a flattening of the tariff commitments. The highest are cut the most, lower tariffs are cut least. Combine that with the fact that South Africa's commitments in the Uruguay round and its applied rate are very close, means that when that formula is applied, it immediately leads to cuts in our tariffs. The developed countries have been reducing tariffs over many, many years. I mean, since they've joined the international trading system, and in general, their tariffs are low. So when you apply the formula to those tariffs, there's very little reductions that emerge out of it. Other developing countries have negotiated a much bigger gap between the bound rates and the applied rates. So when you apply that formula to their tariffs, the effect on their applied rates is much less. So South Africa's peculiarity arising from the Uruguay round is that our bound rates are close to our applied rates, and when you apply the formula, it affects a much wider range of products than any other WTO member. We ran this over many, there's quite a lot of technical work in the WTO. They helped us a lot in the Secretariat to specify the products and the scope, and the result was very clear. South Africa would take the highest and deepest cuts of any member in the WTO without getting additional access.
Chair, could I just ask a point of clarity on what the DDG just said? Does that mean that the formula is a function of the space between the bound and the applied?
No, it's a function of the... It applies to the bound rate. So your legal commitment is made on the bound rate. That's what you specify. So that's what it cuts. But because of that, we don't have the space. So it immediately cuts, almost immediately on most products, cuts directly into the applied tariff in South Africa. Then there was a question about the impact or the lessons of the global crisis. I think this came up in a number of the interventions, and I think there's no doubt that the crisis has made countries much more protective and seeking to protect their economy. So in a sense, it has been an additional factor in leading and maintaining the impasse in the Doha round negotiations. The countries are, this is not necessarily the time to make further tariff liberalization commitments. And despite many undertakings that we should not resort to new protection measures, these are undertakings that have been generally made at the G20 statements that countries should avoid resort to protectionism. The fact of the matter is we've seen around the world growing protectionism in many countries using many different types of measures, not only trade measures, but also monetary monetary measures of different sorts. So countries are looking to protect their economies, and so we've seen a rise across the world in application of measures to protect their economies. And I think that again comes back to the question that was raised: is it dead? Because I think, to some extent, I mean, again, a lot of this is speculation, and so nothing is absolutely clear on this. But perhaps if the crisis was to recede and there was further growth in the global economy, there may be at some point an appetite to return to a multilateral negotiating process. It's not impossible to see that possibility arising in future, but it's clear now that with the crisis not over with, those concerns remain, and that would have implications for reviving the Doha round in the immediate future. I think Honorable Wahile also made that point, and I think that was certainly has had an impact. And then there was a question about Africa, and I think two of the members referred to what extent is Africa have a common position and divisions in Africa. On the main points that I've highlighted, on the main principal points of multilateralism, of the importance of the development agenda in the Doha round, addressing the concerns, I think on those points Africa is coherent and has taken strong stands alongside and within this G90 framework. But there are, when you get down into the details, there are obviously differences depending on some of the specifics. So for instance, on the industrial tariff negotiations, only about 5 or 6 countries in Africa would have been required to take tariff reduction commitments, including South Africa, simply because of the exclusions for many countries, because they had not made binding commitments in the Uruguay round. So for them, this round was about now making binding commitments, so they wouldn't take tariff reduction. So we're all in different positions on this, and so on the industrial tariff negotiations, SACO and a few countries in Africa would have been part of those negotiations. There are also sometimes differences in Africa between on the duty free quota free for LDCs, because there are some African countries that wouldn't benefit from the LDCs, countries that are not LDCs in Africa that are seeking duty-free, quota-free. Issues, positions may not always be the same on that issue. So when we start to get into the details, it's correct that there are differences, but on the main thrust, on the big points that I've tried, the main principal positions, Africa has been quite coherent. The approach to the question of trade facilitation Africa's had a unified position. On the question of LDC services and rules of origin and SMD, Africa's had common positions. And we will be able to circulate the statement communique came out of Addis Ababa last week, which will show where Africa in this agenda has taken common positions. And as far as the plurilateral goes, I think the concern is also there, because Africa, as I said, Africa is not participating in any of these. The question on the citrus black spot, this is an issue that is primarily dealt with by the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries. We have participated and tried to assist in that process. We do see it as a wider context of the rise of new protectionism in many markets. So the point that we were making earlier of in the current context of a global economic crisis, we are seeing a rise of non-tariff barriers and sanitary and phytosanitary measures and measures that will that have an impact on our exports and in general. It's very interesting that the G20 has, and this goes back to the point I was making, the G20 has done an inventory of protectionist measures that have been undertaken over the last 5 years, and far and away from everyone else, the most prominent user of these non-tariff barriers has been major economies of the North, including the European Union. So that citrus is falls within that category. The question was raised about differences between India and China on the one hand and the US, and I think there are a range of different configurations on many of the issues in the Doha round, and I think it's correct to say that there is no discernible closing of the gaps on these negotiations at the moment, on these issues at the moment. There still is, what we would hope for is that there is a post-Bali, there's a work program post-Bali to continue to try to identify ways of narrowing the gaps, but we probably have to wait some time before there's a political basis to move the negotiations forward, and we're likely to be remain in the impasse for some time, but I don't think that's the same thing as saying that we need to abandon the Iran. Not to say that anyone has said that, but I think that's the distinction that needs to be made. And I think from our side, the multilateral approach remains necessary and important, and we should continue to advance our position in that way. There are a range of issues in the trade facilitation negotiations that I'm not sure would be very useful. I'm not a complete expert in this area, but there are a number of areas that are the subject of negotiations in that they're quite technical. I would be prepared to, I think it would be quite relatively easy for us to prepare a briefing rather than trying to explain each of those. It would take quite a lot of time to try to explain each of those. But a briefing on what are the main issues on the trade facilitation negotiations to give further background to honourable members, if that's acceptable. Chair, sorry for taking so long.
No. We actually allowed this time because we there's a lot of deliberation that we need to do, and members may not realise it. So I want to give you your voice a little break, though, as it were. I am coming back to this, members, because this is a serious issue. But I'm also cognizant of how people's time management sometimes works against them due to other commitments that they may have. So I want to do the minutes first. For that, we require a quorum. It'll take 5 to 7 minutes. Will you just enable us to do this? And then we're having a tea break, then we're coming back. Members, there are 6 sets of minutes. We're certainly going to try and get through 3 now. The 17th of September was the engagement of the Office of the Auditor General on the audit outcomes and the deliberations on the Lotteries Amendment Bill. Apart from your names there, please check page 1, the spelling. You'll also check on page 2, we put page 2 there. And then, of course, the register that is attached. Sets of the Hansard is attached for you. We have someone to propose the adoption of that set of minutes. Thank you, Honourable McIntosh, seconded by Honourable Waili. The next set, the 8th of October, which was a Tuesday as well, and that is the briefing on the annual report of the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission and also the Bureau, South African Bureau of Standards, SABS. And page one, just the names there to be aware of. Page two seems to be very straightforward. Is the name spelled correctly there under 3.1, Mr. Herman? Right. And four. Page three. And the attendance register of four. Right, we have someone to propose adoption there, please. Thank you, Honourable James, seconded by the Honourable Kwabasa. The 15th of October, we had public hearings on the legal metrology bill. By the looks of things, this is when it was introduced. Page one. Page two. We have someone to propose adoption. Thank you, Honourable Kwabasa, seconded by Honourable Waili. There we are. The 16th of October, also the legal metrology bill. Page one. Page two. Now, were these the minutes that were also corrected at some point when we were adopting on page three? Not these. Okay. Now, I just want to go through, just look at this again, members. On page two, we're talking about the briefing we got from Dr. Damana here. And then he goes on to say the functions of the national regulator. As a result of the functions, is that one of the functions? I just wondered if we shouldn't have said he explained or gave us or listed. You know, he obviously listed the functions. Market failure is not one of the functions. Yeah. So just sort of a little bit of cleaning up. As a result of market failure, the national regulator must ensure to the public, ensure service to the public, especially in rural towns. You know, I just want that explained a bit better. I think we all know here kind of what you mean and what was said, and maybe it was even said that way, just check the Hansard or whatever. Appointment of market surveillance inspectors and the potential for conflict of interest. Those were serious matters. A state appointment of an organ of state to avoid duplication. The designation of repair bodies, which became quite a big thing. And then finally the registration of importers, etc. I think just let's check on that, please, Mr. Hermans. I want to put these aside just for the moment, please. I don't want us to adopt them at the moment, all right? That is the 16th. The 18th, and that is October, deliberations again, input from Dr. James on the submissions received on the protection of traditional knowledge. We have quite a few people being present then. Right, page one, page two. Right, and also formal consideration of the budget review and recommendation report. And the committee resolved, please look at your resolutions very, very carefully on that one. Those are important ones that, you know, we will follow up. It will become, yes, thank you. but it does reflect the facts. Page 3, and then page 4, the attendance register. We have someone to propose adoption of the minutes of the 18th of October. Thank you, Honourable Waili, seconded by Honourable Kwabasa. Then we go to the last set we're going to adopt today, if we can, Tuesday the 22nd of October, deliberations on the legal metrology, again, just that, only that. And we had page 2, those amendments being referred to. Page 3, again, further amendments being referred to. And page 4. Page 5. Committee focused on the following, and the issues noticed there. The DTI agreed that an inaccurate measure could include a short measure, etc., but not the other way around. The meeting concluded. Last page, noting your attendance.
Yeah.
Honourable James?
On page 5, the very last paragraph, well, second to last, before closure, the second line doesn't make any sense to me. It says, legislation drafted must be user-friendly, hence the use of idiomatic phrases in some instances. And what's confusing about that is that, is it because of the use of idiomatic phrases that it should become user-friendly, or does one make it user-friendly by using idiomatic expressions? So, I'm sorry.
I'm smiling because it's the kind of thing I've seen before, and we all know what it means more or less because we were there. But in fact, if somebody else reads this, they'd come to the same conclusion that you've just come. Which way is it? Can we just swing that around to mean what it should mean, Mr. Hermans, and that is legislation drafted must, in the, you know, just, yeah, well, look, there was quite a thing about these idiomatic phrases. You've got to capture that, but capture it correctly. Yes, Honourable James.
I mean, can I have a proposal would be legislation drafted must be user-friendly and avoid the use of idiomatic phrases. Or by avoiding the use of idiomatic phrases.
But that wasn't the decision. You see, no, but I know what you meant, and that's not what's reflected here. It was, they'd used idiomatic phrases and said, it's quite in order in legislation to do so. But the sentence itself is not quite capturing that thought. All right. So, yes, Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, I think the phrase means the latter, and I think it's referring to short measure, which is, it could be idiomatic, although if it becomes accepted into statute, it then becomes a technical word.
No, it wasn't on short measure. I can't think what it was. Oh, yeah, I was about to say level the gravel or something, but it's level the playing field. Yes, that's what it was, to level. And it was used in the legislation, the levelling of playing fields. All right. Now, perhaps the way to have said it is to have noted that phrase. What did it refer to? And simply note that the use of idiomatic phrases does not compromise legislation. That is basically what was said. But I think you put the phrase in, people may one day want to revisit that issue. So that is exactly what it was, levelling of the playing fields, and someone said that's an idiomatic expression, and we were told, well, by the state law advisor and Australian that no, that does not compromise the legislation. And that's all, but it doesn't say so here. Yeah. Of course it is to make legislation, what do you call it, user-friendly and whatever, but then again we're going to all kinds of little colloquialisms. Just clean it up. I think, should we get these minutes back again, and then you quite, we'll see what it says in the next on the next occasion. But we know it's the idiomatic. Not too serious, we're all, you know, levelling and whatever. Okay, 22nd and the 16th will come back. On that note, we're going to take a short... We're actually coming back on the issue of WTO. Oh, on the minutes, yes. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Chair, a few days ago we asked for a corrected attendance schedule, attendance register, with all of the meetings reflected?
No, the only thing is, it wasn't really asked in committee, but nevertheless, it was referred to the chair, and you're asking, has this been addressed? That's really what it amounts to. An issue came up from Mr. Hill Lewis, which he referred to me, in connection with our meetings, the number of meetings we have had this year. And I indicated I was also concerned, and he pointed out that he had actually done a detailed reconciliation, as it were, of it. And there was a disjuncture, a non-alignment between the reality of the number of meetings and what was reflected in this, I understand, semi-official recon. Because Mr. Herman then explained, well, that's not his recon. However, that came from Parliament. And Mr. Hermans, what have you ascertained?
Chairperson, we have had a discussion with this, our admin unit who are dealing with that. We then decided that we ourselves will do the recon, so we will verify and do the proper recon in terms of that and correct what they have done. So hopefully by the end of the day we will forward that to members.
I think it's rather vital in the current political climate for that to be done for a number of members. All right. So really we'd like it, and just email it directly out to each member, please. Thank you very much, and thanks for reminding me. Just a 10-minute, what do you call it, tea break, comfort break, the rest.
Do the briefing meeting, which I think will be very helpful, and also the follow-up documents to prepare us some more details on what the food security proposals were. I'm a great skeptic of the idea of food security. I think it's thinly veiled agricultural protectionism on the part of most developed countries. But I'd like to see what the negotiations are all about. I haven't read enough about what's going on at the moment to know. Then I have two questions. Firstly, this phenomenon of round tripping. We've seen this quite recently in the massive increase in chicken imports from the Netherlands. The minister showed us a graph in this committee. I think, if memory serves me correctly, there was something like a 2,000% increase in imports. Now, surely under rules of origin, that's not allowed. That if that produce is coming from other countries, and the suggestion or the inference is that it's coming from places like Brazil, then under RO that's not allowed. That would be in contravention of WTO rules. I'd like your comments on that. Then, lastly, on the bids. You know, well, let me just preface what I'm about to say by saying I actually agree with your arguments around the bids. And I think we've needed a kind of overarching piece of legislation for some time. But when you and the minister were in this committee much, much earlier this year, somewhere around March, you conceded at the time, that was just after you had cancelled the bits with Belgium and Spain. You conceded at the time that you had learnt a lot of lessons about the way that had been communicated and that there was some improvements that you could make going forward. But what's just happened with Germany is just a repetition of what happened earlier in the year, if not even worse. They seem to have been caught completely unawares of what was coming, and it certainly seems as though their concerns were not adequately pacified before the announcement was made that the bid was being cancelled. Now, you know, this has resulted in a whole lot of unnecessary panic and concern around something which is really just quite logical and really is no cause for panic. So, you know, again, as I put to you, and I think it was March or April, whenever it was, I do think that the department has really bungled the communication around this issue. And this, you know, insofar as there are still to be bits cancelled between now and when we adopt this piece of legislation that's imminent, I really do think a lot more effort needs to be made to reach out to our trading partners, explain to them what is happening, go and visit them in their countries, whatever the case is, and pacify them. Because as you say, it may be the case that FDI, we've had a bumper year, but it makes these people very skittish unnecessarily. The second thing on bits is that, you know, I really do think something like this piece of legislation and the full briefing that the minister is going to give on Monday should have been 12 months ago, perhaps even 18 months ago. So that instead of there being a gap now between when bits are cancelled and the legislation being enacted, and we don't know how long that gap could be, it could be 12 months plus, in which there's so much unnecessary uncertainty, which is the enemy of FDI, as you well know, we could have had this preempting all of this panic and really just done it proactively. So I do think there are a lot of lessons to be learned here. I hope that the department is learning it as they go, though, because what I've seen now with the German bits is not encouraging.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hilders. Anyone else? Right. Honourable Waihili.
I think two issues, Honourable Chairperson. I think given the challenges, especially around the agricultural projects and the consistent approach, the one of rigidity in terms of the industrialized countries in terms of protectionism. What else can we do? Because the fundamental issue is that our farmers who are producing food are not subsidized now. And we continue to box with the industrialized countries to say, can you relax some of the subsidies? And it's a battle which we're not sure when I will win it, because there's no scientific measuring tool as to when are we going to win that particular battle. But can we begin to, I understand this notion that we must not resort to protectionism, but if the industrialized countries are subsidizing the farmers at the detriment of the developing countries, does it mean that we must adopt the liberal stance and on whose interest? Because some of these battles are not purely religious battles. These are the ideological battles, which at times we must be able to unmask the nature and the character of this battle. But I'm just checking as to, are there the what kind of unintended consequences if we were to follow that particular route? The last one is the unit. If you read page 3 on the Doha round, there's an element that deals with the alliances between South Africa, the Africa Group, G20, and G90. Economically, how strong are these blocks that we cannot wield any power in terms of beginning to break or to tilt the balance of forces? Because whilst we're dealing with these matters in the trade, World Trade Organization, I understand that simultaneously there's a process in terms of the United Nations General Assembly, where there's a call from the countries of the South and the developing nations calling for the reforms in the global institution. Is there any alignment in terms of the battle that we're waging in the World Trade Organization and other battles that are waged in other global forums? Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Waili. Let's turn to the Mr. McKerim, because I also think, Mr. Karim, if you could look at some of the pertinent issues from your position as DDG in the department there and in that division. With respect to, I know you've tried to spell out the challenges with Doha, etc., but perhaps if you could make re-emphasize or clarify this in relation to other issues we are dealing with, the G20 issues, the United Nations democratization, World Bank, you name it, including some of the many issues in the WTO that we have been able to work through successfully over the last 10 years. You know, what is it that we can do, and why do you think that it is so important, other than the points you've put here? Why not just give up, technically speaking? What would be the impact for us and for other developing economies?
Thank you very much, Chair. And again, thanks to all the honourable members for the very pertinent questions. The Honourable Swanepoel asked about who is participating in the plurilaterals, and that is Africa the only group that's excluded. I think first of all there are three plurilaterals that are currently underway. There is a
round of negotiations on government procurement and the government procurement agreement. Now, this was a plurilateral agreement that emerged during the Uruguay round. So it was always a small group of countries that were that took on obligations in that area and have commitments in that area. It's mainly OECD countries, one or two developing countries like Singapore, if I'm not mistaken. But it's primarily OECD countries that have joined that. Now there's an attempt to have a second round of negotiations or a new agreement or step up that agreement. That negotiation is going on. South Africa is not part of it. And again, most other countries, developing countries, are not part of it. China has been negotiating in that, but it doesn't seem that they've managed to conclude that round yet. So that's the first one, and that's a plurilateral that has come out of the previous round, the Uruguay round. There is a trade and trade in services agreement. Now, it's not strictly a plurilateral in a legal sense, because there is a provision in the General Agreement on Trade and Services in the WTO which allows for regional arrangements to be negotiated. It's being presented as a regional arrangement among some countries. So in a strict legal sense, it's not a plurilateral, it's not being negotiated separately, but it is about amongst a group of countries which is allowed for in the services agreement. And then there is another agreement which was negotiated in the immediate post the conclusion of the Uruguay round in the 1990s, information technology agreement. Again, a number of countries have been participating in that, but no one from Africa, as far as I'm aware, certainly not South Africa. I think that China may be in participating now, but most of the other countries are not. One of the key questions that arises, what distinguishes, say, the ITA from the government procurement agreement is the application of another principle in the WTO, the most favored nation principle. Under the ITA, even though it's a small group of countries that negotiate commitments to reduce tariffs on a list of goods that constitute information technology, that tariff reduction is then applied to all the members. So a subgroup negotiates, they reduce their tariffs for trading those goods, but those reduced tariffs are then applied to everyone. So South Africa can trade to any one of those countries at the reduced level, but we don't have to reciprocate. So that's one way of dealing with, that's one approach to plurilateral. The government procurement agreement is exclusive. So first, it's inclusive in the sense that it allows all other members to participate. The government procurement agreement is exclusive in that the benefits that arise or the improvements in trade that arise from that agreement are only extended to members of that agreement. So it's an exclusive club. And the question then arises, how will the other plurilateral? I know I understand that in the TISA agreement, the trade and services, there's a debate amongst those members that are negotiating it whether or not it should be, the benefits that come out of it should be extended to everyone else, which would be more WTO compatible, or should it be remain an exclusive group. And that's a debate that has not been concluded as far as I know. We're not part of that negotiation, so I'm not always aware of developments so I think that is the main issue. Africa, as I said, is not participating in any of these. The BRICS, aside from China, I know, are not participating in any of these. I think China has made tried to negotiate on government procurement, but it's not concluded. That negotiation is not concluded. The second set of questions doesn't the TFTA, the tripartite, represent a plurilateral? In legal terms, it's not. It is obviously an arrangement amongst a subgroup of members of the WTO, but the WTO agreement, Article 24, allows for regional arrangements to be negotiated. So it's not a departure from the single the principle of the single undertaking in that sense. It is allowed for that regional arrangements can continue, and the tripartite would certainly fall into that. But I think at one level there is a similarity, but at another level it's a legal arrangement. And whereas the plurilaterals that we've seen are in fact taking certain issues that are contained in the Doha round and trying to negotiate those in a separate manner. There was a question about the food security. We'll provide a little bit more background on that. Our reading of it is that this is the proposal from India and the G33 is a proposal which we believe is a genuine and legitimate concern. India has in the region of 700 million poor people, 700 million poor people. In fact, the largest proportion of poor people in the world, larger than we have even in Africa combined. These are many of them are subsistence farmers, and the food security provision that they're proposing is that they're able to establish a minimum price for the products, and to stockhold them, to create holdings of these agriculture products, which they would pay a minimum amount to the farmers, and also sell this to other poor people, provide it to other poor people in India. So the way that we've understood it, it's a way to safeguard the poor farmers in India, but also to provide subsidized food to other poor people in urban areas and etc. But that constitutes a subsidy. And the subsidy limits that India has committed to in the Uruguay round, those limits were defined in 1990. The time was 1990. So if they're going to affect this mechanism, they would exceed the limits of their commitments and thereby be exposed to a dispute settlement charge. Now, clearly the rules, if they're going to be fair, would need to address those types of concerns. It seems clear to us, it seems to us legitimate. Particularly if you look at the amounts of subsidies that are allowed, have been negotiated and allowed for developed countries. The levels of subsidies that developed countries are allowed to deploy to their farmers is much larger than anything that India is considering. And this is precisely one of the imbalances in the rules of the Uruguay round that we're trying to address. So legally speaking, India, if they were to implement this, would be in violation of its obligations, but it seems to us to be unfair, and it seems to be legitimate. And India has tried to indicate and provide as much assurance to trading partners that this is not simply a protectionist measure, it's not aimed at distorting international trade. Its primary objective is to provide a degree of food security to its people. There was a question of the round-tripping and the question of chickens and round-tripping, possibility of round-tripping from Brazil via Netherlands. I have yet to see any proof of that. I think we've heard a number of countries, a number of companies indicate this, but we've not seen any proof that this is indeed the case. I also understand that Netherlands is a fairly competitive large producer of chicken itself. And in the context of some of the increases in tariffs that we've applied on the MFN basis, this would give an additional advantage to countries in the EU that we've, under the TDCA, we've reduced the tariffs on chicken for those countries. So inevitably, perhaps inevitably, but we've seen that the imports have now shifted from Brazil to Netherlands. But the question of round tripping, you're right, would not be allowed when we apply the rules of origin. But there's not been any concrete evidence that I've seen to suggest that it is happening like that. On the question of the bids, again, I ought to leave that really for the minister to answer fully. And let me not preempt what he will say on Monday. I would say there is one article, very interesting article in the Business Day today, a commentator from Holland actually thanking South Africa for terminating the bid with Holland because of the problems that they believe it leads to. Then there is there was a question. I think this follows on what I've said from the question from Honourable Wahile on the agricultural the unfairness of the agricultural trade regime internationally, and clearly this is one of the was one of the major objectives of this round, was to try to address agriculture. And it's really, these constitute what we would say are unfair and inequitable rules that emerged out of the Uruguay round. But these are legally binding. And if we're going to respond, we have to find the legal possibilities for doing that. And this could involve trying to find other ways to support our farmers. Perhaps finding new markets for our farmers, particularly in Africa, through the tripartite process or through SADC. So one would have to say that we understand the imbalances in the round in the rules that we have to that have arisen out of the Uruguay round. Those impose legal constraints on how we can respond. But we would need to find ways of legally, in a way that can't be challenged, find ways of trying to support our farmers, either through some scope of domestic support, but also perhaps through new markets that we haven't traditionally focused on, particularly in Africa where it's growing. And I don't have much of a better answer than that. On the question of the strength of alliances, I think in general what we can say is that the alliances that we've developed have been effective insofar as we are have not been in a situation where we've been forced to accept unfair deals. Unlike the Uruguay round, where all the problems that we've identified, for instance, in agriculture, were negotiated by a few countries and then effectively imposed on the rest of the membership. This round, we've avoided that through the G90, the G20, the NAMA 11. Those alliances have effectively managed to ensure that we are not able to accept or be required to take on a new round of unfair agreements. So in effect, it's been we're able to now block an unfair round, but with insufficient strength to actually reverse that. And really, that's the reason for the impasse. No one has been able to impose their will
on the other side. There was a question, I think, from the chair, and I sort of link it to the last part of the question on the alignment of the reforms in different fora. I think, in broad terms, the same approach that we've taken as a country towards reform of multilateral institutions, of the Security Council, of the IMF, of the World Bank, is, in broad terms, that's what we've tried to do in the WTO, to give greater voice to the concerns of developing countries, advance the interests of developing countries. The contexts are different. The mechanisms for negotiations are different. The WTO does require consensus by all members to reach decisions, and so that creates a different dynamic to a situation where there's weighted voting, for instance, in the IMF. And so there are differences in the mechanisms, but the general objective of trying to give greater voice to developing countries has been, I think, central to our approach in the negotiations. And the chair's question was, why don't we give up, I mean, given the difficulties? And I would say that our reading is these negotiations take time. The Uruguay round took more than 8 years, but it had many, many less countries that were involved. The membership was a little more than 100 at the time. It's now 155 or 156 at the moment. So the membership itself has grown. The number of issues that are being negotiated are much more than they were during the Uruguay round. The complexity of the negotiations is different. Long negotiations are part of our process. If I compare the EFA negotiations, which is just a few countries negotiating with the European Union, that's already taken 11 years. So it's not unusual that negotiations, complex negotiations like this, take a long time. And our sense is that we are still trying to address the imbalances in the Uruguay round and all the objectives that we had set for ourselves at the beginning of the round. In our view, certainly from the department's view, we need to continue to pursue. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much, Mr. Karim. And I think that's the point. The negotiations are not a short process. We've never found that to be the case at all. But simply because they do take so long doesn't mean to say that one should now just simply, almost overnight, decide, well, no point in carrying on pursuing the same negotiations, because there are so many major countries, developed world, who are opposed to something. It isn't surprising that the developed world are opposed to the Doha round, although in the end there was, for it to become the Doha round, there must have been consensus given the constituency and constitution and the position adopted by the WTO. You don't simply put something on agenda that is entirely opposed or agree to it. But over the years, one has seen the priority issues really changing quite dramatically. Kind of issue that's put there, I see more and more focus on the environmental issues, on the carbon issues in that area, on the industrial ones, services. Agriculture has just become a back foot here, back foot. And yet, for many, they can afford that back foot because they've already protected their agriculture. But it literally denies the developing world the opportunity to do the same. And I certainly think that the proposal of India, it is almost surprising, and in fact one may even say shocking, to think that the simple proposal to assist the majority, the poor people there's such a huge number of poor people as far as the world is concerned, that that doesn't make any headway in the WTO. What does it say that the goal is of this organization? Is it the goal to really bring about change in the world generally and to ensure that there is fair trade? What does fair trade mean? What is trade expected to do? Who's getting the benefits of this? The people or the countries who don't need quite the same support continue to rely on legitimate subsidies. Legitimate. But we can't do that, and neither can other developing countries who really are in a far more serious situation than even South Africa is. The other issue, which for me is very important here, is the constant undermining of this the multilateral process itself. We see this happening internationally, and it only creates more problems, so that people undermine the very institutions such as the United Nations to put forward their own position and to create, in the end, more challenges than they have tried to address. Are we going to see the same thing happening in trade as well? And I think that, in so many ways, we must protect, we must support that principle of multilateralism. We can't support the principle of coalitions all over, and coalitions that don't include the countries that desperately require fair trade. The other point that one would like to stress here are the issues around the, how should we look at this? Why are we even going to Bali? Is it simply to get an accord that we continue with the discussions? I do believe the more and more you push other countries, you're able to spend time with them, persuading them, and to make the voice of the undeveloped or the developing countries stronger, it is going to make a difference along the line. It eventually will. Some countries, during their hour, as it were, of greatest economic need, felt similar pressures to the developing countries. So there may be enough time, even in Bali, where they may, one or two of them may at least be persuaded to think differently, not to review their position. They're not going to review that position overnight at all. But I do want to see that those members who are successful in being able to take up the invitation that the department offered, that they will remember when they get there to Bali that they represent South Africa, South Africa's interests, and that we go together as a solid block from our own country in the same way that Europeans go there, Americans go there, other countries go there. They don't go there with three or four different positions in the different directions. We remember that we are all South Africans in this regard. But while we're getting there, let's try and push for a position here. And what we would like to do, TDG, is our trade report, which will embrace this particular engagement as well. We know it'll be ready long before the Bali trip and so on. And we hope the department too will take cognizance of what the committee is saying in this regard. But once we've said that, we'll go together as South Africans. I think I must stress that particular position. And I know that while Doha seems very elusive, I expect you could say freedom at one stage seemed elusive. People didn't stop. They continued their pursuit of that. I would like to thank you once again, DDG, for coming here. I know you've had a very long 2 days, as it were, schedules all over. We do appreciate it. We appreciate the cooperation you're providing to us on the trade report itself by Ms. Herling, Mr. Hermans, and Ms. Marilani, so that we can ensure we've captured all the areas effectively in this regard. To the committee, I want to thank you for your time here today and to remind you through Mr. Hermans when we're meeting again.
Chairperson, our next scheduled meeting is on Tuesday the 5th of November and Wednesday the 6th of November, and then we will communicate further meetings after on Wednesday.
Just might remind them about the issue of the 12th.
The Parliament has scheduled a additional days for plenaries, which is the 12th and 13th. The date of the 12th is the plenary will be starting on at 10 o'clock,
10
in the morning, and on Wednesday there's no plenary scheduled as I know it at this moment. But the committee will probably most likely meet on the 13th of November.
Yes, that's for the anti-piracy issue, an outstanding one. We may, we do want to get our trade report onto the ATC, etc., and, you know, adopted and so on, adequately before the, you know, the 12th and so on. So please keep that in mind as well. There is talk of us trying to find another opportunity for our meetings, because I believe the 12th is a Wednesday. 12th is Tuesday. The 13th is Wednesday. And we may be in for a long day on the 13th itself. It looks like the legal metrology bill for debate will go through on the 5th of November, but the 5th of November is going to be a very long day in the House. I'm sure you can see that from the schedules that are there. It looks like 7 o'clock by the sound of it. Yes. Honourable Hildur?
Chair, there's no other parties here, but I mean, we would be very happy to forego that debate due to the relatively uncontroversial nature of the legal metrology bill. If the ANC would agree as well, we could just have declarations.
Well, I think the decision has already been taken that it will be a debate, primarily because it is a new bill after how many years, which changes the landscape. And, you know, I've certainly indicated, in view of its non-controversial nature, as I see it, that we should have as short a debate as possible in that regard. So, and, you know, I do hope everyone will support it. I know you don't speak for all the parties, but my own impression is they will. They will. Right. All right, on that note, please have a constructive weekend and return on Tuesday. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.